Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to the New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nick C., a host of the channel, and today I'll be talking with my guest, Dr. Erica Marat, about her book, The Politics of Police Reform, Society Against State in Post-Soviet Countries, published by Oxford University Press in 2018. Dr. Marat is an associate professor and the chair of Regional and Analytical Studies Department at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. Her research focuses on violence, mobilization, and security institutions in Eurasia, India, and Mexico. She's the author of three books, most recently, The Politics of Police Reform, which we'll be discussing today. She also has several articles published in Foreign Affairs, Washington Post, Foreign Policy, Eurasianet, and Open Democracy. Erica, thanks for joining us today, and welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me on your show. I'm so delighted.
I'm excited, too, and I think we'll have a lot to talk about today. And just kind of as an introduction into your book, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your research background and how you came to work on this project, which seems very relevant in 2020.
Sure. So I was born in Kyrgyzstan. I was born and raised in Kyrgyzstan. And one of the reasons why I was so interested in policing and the institution of policing is because while growing up in Kyrgyzstan in the 90s, after the end of the Soviet regime, when lots of government public systems collapsed, you know, was schools not functioning, public transport not being reliable, even utilities. I remember we didn't have, you know, things like electricity or water on a regular basis. I saw that the police had a constant presence on the street. And from time to time, I also noticed violent interactions between the police and ordinary citizens. So I always wondered, how is it that when everything else is in decline and not reliable, we always see the presence of police on the streets of Bishkek, my hometown, and that not only that, but they also are quite violent and in that sense, unchecked by the society, they can behave in the way they seems like they want to behave. So that's how I came to the idea of researching police as an institution, and not only in Kyrgyzstan, but the more I learned about Kyrgyzstan, the more I saw that there are parallels of how police function in other former Soviet states, and there is this common Soviet legacy that countries that I research, Ukraine, Georgia, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, share as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, the narrative you're telling about policing seems really familiar to me. I know that there, like in the United States right now, there are a lot of conversations going on about why are the budgets of police departments still so stable when other services seem to be altering. And obviously, it's not a direct one-to-one comparison, but I find that similarity striking, and maybe we can talk about that later in the interview. But I wanted to come back to this point you made just now about kind of the legacy of Soviet policing, and specifically how that relates to the countries you chose for your case study. So you look at Georgia, Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Kazakhstan to some extent. Why specifically these countries of the former Soviet Union, and also what is the legacy of policing that these former Soviet countries have kind of inherited from the Soviet Union?
So all post-Soviet countries inherited a similar type of police forces. Police forces were highly politicized, so they function in support of whoever is in power, and that's unlike the Soviet military or post-Soviet military for that matter. Centralized in control, so under interior minister, but decentralized in their reach, controlling all parts of former Soviet space. And also one of the bigger legacies of Soviet policing was that police performed a wide range of functions that didn't necessarily have to do with public security, public order, but things like issuing ID, performing surveillance, even engaging in law enforcement education and public schools. So they really have broad reach and they played a prominent part in the Soviet regime, and they continue to play the same prominent part in post-Soviet kind of reality as well. And the reason I was interested in Kyrgyzstan, Georgia, and Ukraine is because even though we saw democratization in those countries and competitive elections in which political leaders like Saakashvili or Yushchenko, or in Kyrgyzstan like Almazbek Atambayev, won elections, even though they wanted to reform police forces, and they indeed declared their ambitious intentions, and Saakashvili is the most notorious one, of course, the police still remained politicized and well-funded and opaque institution. And political incumbents, to a lesser degree in Georgia, of course, but very much so in Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine, democratically elected political incumbents, they continue to rely on the political loyalty of the police forces. So my question really in the book that I ask is, what does it take to reform a post-Soviet police force? Or, what does it take to undo those Soviet legacies of politicized and militarized police?
Yeah, and I definitely want to tackle this question because I think you give some concrete answers, which I think will be very interesting for our listeners. But I wanted to ask one more question about these kind of different case studies and kind of the weight of, I guess I want to ask about the weight of that Soviet legacy of policing and whether or not there are divergent experiences among these different countries. I know, for instance, in one section of the book, you talk about how broken windows policing, which comes from New York City, actually played a major role in some in policing in post-Soviet Kazakhstan. But I'm wondering if there are other examples. You mentioned Georgia and Ukraine. Are these outliers? Do we see kind of divergent tracks in terms of how policing develops in these different post-Soviet countries, or is there a kind of uniformity among them?
So the major uniformity among all former Soviet states that I study, but also, I can see parallels here in the United States as well, is that when police and political leaders announce ambitious police reforms, and they do it, publicly, and they want to change, it's not going to happen unless there is a wide and broad participation from non-state actors, from civil society groups. And the conclusion is that police are not going to reform themselves, especially with the legacies that the countries that I study inherited after the collapse of the Soviet regime. Police are not going to give away their power over the society just like that. And in the former Soviet space, just like in most parts of the world, police are also extremely corrupt, and they're able to use their monopoly over the over violence. So, you know, the legal ability to arrest people, to use violence against people, they're able to leverage that and take bribes, extract bribes from the population. And of course, you know, there is a discussion that people are also willing to pay bribes when they break law so that they avoid the legal system. But the point I'm trying to make is the police are not going to reform themselves. Even political leaders who come to power will not reform police. There has to be a push bottom up from citizens, activists, opposition political leaders, journalists, and here in the United States, there are prominent NGOs or activist movements that will demand that the police open up, use less violence, become more responsive to citizens' needs in what the citizens require for public order, and not what the state imagines it to be through policing. So yeah, this is the takeaway, that the police are not going to reform themselves, and all those ambitious reforms, they are just a way of presenting what I call in some places refurbishment of police. Refurbishment, you know, meaning buying new guns, new uniforms, or coming up with techniques like broken windows policing that was completely really criticized here in the US, but somehow took root and became popular in other parts of the world. So top-down police reform is likely to be boosting the powers of the police, not giving away powers of the police.
Yeah, and I think that's an important reading of that. I mean, it seems highly skeptical of calls to reform, but there seems to be a healthy skepticism there. And I want to come back to this main question that you seek to answer in the book, because you've alluded to some of the kind of variables you see as being important for meaningful reform of police. And one of them you've mentioned as kind of NGOs, kind of putting being able to organize and put pressure on authorities. And I think you call this pre-existing dissent infrastructure. So I guess in addition to that, you mention transformative violence and also a focus on state-society collaboration and renegotiating I guess what it means to police. But these are the three variables that you come up, and I was hoping we could go through each one and kind of provide some examples of when these variables resulted in actual reform of the police and how that operated. So what do you mean by transformative violence as kind of the starting voice of police reform?
Right. So transformative violence is the type of violence that really mobilizes the public to act. And police may be a violent institution, and certain groups or all of the societies suffer from their violent means of dealing with citizens. But there is one violent event that will spark this outrage, and it will be a tipping point for people to mobilize against this violence. And in Eurasia or in former Soviet space, what I find is that these kind of requests, the mobilization, the public mobilization against police brutality, took place in response to transformative violence, and also, usually it happened during, when people convened for other political reasons, but then the police attacked them, and then the people switched just from opposing political issue to just opposing the coercive functions of the state. And that's when we see various civil society networks joining forces or becoming more loud and demanding reform and channeling what most people in the society feel about the police. And for that, we do need to have, in countries like, again, Ukraine, Georgia, Kyrgyzstan, we did have this pre-existing dissent infrastructure. This is a term I borrow from mobilization literature about the infrastructure of civil society groups. And it doesn't have to be just organized in, NGOs or whatever other, collectives, civic collectives. It can be individual activists who can be really effective. It can be journalists. Very often, it is former police officers who just couldn't change things from inside, but got so disgruntled they left the Interior Ministry, so want to change it from outside, as civil society members. It can be former inmates. And together, we see that those networks and individuals, they come, they mobilize their forces and they start demand change. So there has to be, unfortunately, the conclusion I make is that there has to be this one transformative moment that really, really sparks public outrage so that both interior ministries and political leadership feel like there is no other way but actually open up to demands from below. And so we see this happen again and again in the former Soviet space. We see this happen here in the United States. This summer was the murder of George Floyd. As we speak now, similar protests are happening in Nigeria against a specific case of police brutality. And that's basically, again, people saying enough is enough. And this is when most changes can actually take place within policing as an institution, as a practice.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I in just a little bit, I do want to actually dive more into what's happening in the United States, because I think it raises some interesting questions about the ability to compare these two cases. And I have some questions about what you think the future of Black Lives Matter and the call for reforming or even abolishing police in the United States will look like, and whether or not we can call what's happening a success or not. I mean, there are so many questions about what happened this past summer that I think some of your insights might be able to illuminate. So this brings us back to the third point I want to talk about, the third aspect of your answer to this big question that you're asking about what needs to happen in order for the police to be successfully reformed. And you mentioned state society collaboration, and I think when you were talking about this, you're talking about reimagination of the relationship between police violence or police use of violence and the way that they relate to society. But I was hoping you could elaborate on that a little bit further.
Yes, thank you for bringing this issue back again, because it is one of the central parts of the book that the way I define the very notion of police reform, it's not really, you know, buying new guns, new uniforms, new cars, or even new techniques that police use to bring public order. But it really is this ongoing collaboration and consensus, search for consensus between society and the police. Because the understanding of what the society needs from the police constantly changes as we identify new social problems, we become more tolerant to certain behaviors, let's say, you know, use of marijuana, or you know, the majority of society, you know, anywhere in the world become more tolerant of sexual minorities. So, and then the understanding of what police need to do constantly changes in the society, and the negotiation of how the police should take place is the very essence of the of change and of by definition of reform as well. And this state-society collaboration is likely to take place again in the aftermath of transformative violent events, when both interior ministries and state political leadership feel like it's really it's going to cost them a lot if they don't open up to input from non-state actors. And this kind of collaboration did take place in post-Soviet countries, in Georgia, Kyrgyzstan, and in Ukraine. There were even attempts for this kind of collaboration, for the push, you know, from of the bottom-up perspective in more autocratic countries like Kazakhstan and Tajikistan. However, initial opening to these ideas quickly followed by those windows of opportunities shutting down when interior ministries and political leaders felt like the general public interest in police reform is declining, even though civil society is still active. And that's when the police reforms become, again, those top-down ventures, unfortunately, in former Soviet space. But that's not to say that some progress has been made in all of these countries in bringing bottom-up perspective on how police need to function. And I have to tell you that, I mean, I have to be very clear about this, that police reform and this kind of state-society collaboration, it always, almost always brings to less violence or use of, you know, lesser violence by the police against the public. The public demands that the police are less punitive but more collaborative. They're more understanding. They're more there to patrol as opposed to punish a small disorderly behavior or criminal behavior.
And I think this kind of illuminates another point you were trying to make in the book, specifically by looking at kind of I guess looking at like the cyclical nature of these interactions, right? You sort of come to the conclusion that this has to be a constant battle, right? Like that the public has to be constantly engaged with limiting the power of police institutions to regain that sense of authority that allows them to commit these kind of more radical acts of violence against people. Which to me seems like a really, I don't know, like a pessimistic way of looking at this question. So,
yeah.
I mean, I guess my question is how did you come to this conclusion, and are you looking at, what kind of time span are you looking at when you think about the cyclical nature of mm-hmm. These different cases of this kind of peak moment around the transformative violence and the call for demand to transform policing, and then kind of that energy kind of seems to fade out over time. I mean, what kind of timeline are we looking at? Do you see any similarities across these different cases in Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan?
So, yes, it is a cyclical nature because there are, you know, there are violent events that spark civil society to get together, to mobilize civil society, and then the state opens up, and then for a while nothing happens. So not, you know, by definition, not all violent events can be transformative. So it's just some of them are. Yeah, it is a cyclical nature. I think it is just to the point, it just kind of confirms that the notion that police reform is a never ending process. There is no such thing as, okay, here we are, we arrived at a great policing, police and policing techniques, and that's it, we're not going to change anymore. Police officers are the type of bureaucrats that everyday citizens or citizens interact with in the most frequently in everyday life. So this is really a very complicated relationship. And in terms of cycles and their duration, they tend to be fairly quick between, you know, when there is a window of opportunity opens up for civil society to make an impact. And then when interior ministers shut down opportunities for bottom-up influence, you know, a couple of years at most. But there have been, in all the three countries that have seen democratic openings, there have been several opportunities like that. And each time some of the changes, you know, for instance, accountability mechanisms that were installed over interior ministry, so they were, some of them were rolled back, but some of them stayed, and those the things that stick, they really do stick, and they do amount to gradual cultural shift over time. And it's really, you know, I don't think it's possible to undo everything in the police, you know, within a short span of time. Even in Georgia, I don't think that happened. You know, it's a different case, and it requires more discussion, I think. But in former Soviet space, it's usually a matter of a couple of years. I think in Western countries where you have more established venues for civil society or society and state collaboration, like, for instance, courts or elected officials, NGOs, prominent NGOs, then those cycles take much longer time. And for instance, again, I keep repeating, I keep coming back to the U.S. context because it really helps illustrate some of the points. But for instance, in the 80s, there was a lot of discussion on how to police domestic violence, and that policing changed. In the 90s, there were a lot of discussions how to police LGBT groups or LGB groups, you know, not so much the T aspect, unfortunately, in the 90s. And then in 2000s, the Muslims. And then I think 2010s, starting with Trayvon Martin, and now until George Floyd, a lot of attention now is, you know, the cycle now of a public discussion and state-society collaboration is focused on how do we police Black men and women in the United States.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the U.S. case, because I think maybe it can illuminate. I mean, I think people will find this interesting, but I think it can also illuminate some of the things that we're trying to get at. So I'm curious how, you know, this is not a post-Soviet space that we're talking about, but I'm curious how this model of transformative violence, pre-existing dissent infrastructure, and state-society collaboration, like, can tell us something about, or maybe not, or, you know, or maybe it falls short of telling us something about the way it operates in the United States, because it seems like we've had so many of these transformative moments when, I mean, there are moments when this kind of violence happens and the media hardly picks it up. But then there are times when it does seem to become a kind of moment of transformation. I mean, we could go back to the Rodney King riots. We could talk about, you know, the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson. We can talk about George Floyd and also the murder of Breonna Taylor this summer. But still it feels like things are changing, but at the same time, not quickly enough. And so, you know, we see these calls for police reform that were pretty intense over the summer and arguably have kind of disappeared to some extent. And I'm curious if the your studies in these various post-Soviet countries can tell us anything about why that might be the case.
I can see how my approach to transformative violence can't really explain all types of mobilization. And here in the United States, I thought Trayvon Martin was the transformative moment. Of course, you know, a couple of decades ago, we saw the same happen. It was Rodney King. Then I thought Michael Brown was that tipping point. But then there were a whole series of similar shootings and killings by the police. And now with George Floyd. I think that Rodney King was definitely, you know, one of those moments of mobilization of networks. And then with the killing of Trayvon Martin and then in a quick succession with Michael Brown, it was really, that's when civil society networks consolidated and Black Lives Matter as a movement emerged and kind of made it a national issue. And since then the discussion continues. So for me, really, those moments of beginning of change were really in 2012, 2014 with Trayvon and Michael Brown. And that's when those pre-existing dissent infrastructures started really consolidating, expanding. So because the activists were there all the way, you know, civic activists, but they really entered the national scene and started demanding change. And yeah, and it's very important that there is, and I mentioned that in the book, that there is a visual communication of what happens, of the type of violence that happens. There has to be a depiction, a visual depiction. And, you know, this is explained in other theories and communication theories as well, that images, compelling images really can mobilize feelings. They invoke emotions, a sense of urgency, and they prompt people to act. And the frustration was that it continues to happen and it's very slow. I get it. This is the same with the former Soviet space, but this frustration is also there. You know, because the changing police, undoing the police, really takes time. It's not an overnight thing. It's not going to happen. You can't undo decades of punitive policing just within a couple of years. But the changes are taking place, I think. The changes are taking place. And maybe it will take another, I don't know, decade or two before we can actually talk about progress. And it's very frustrating, I know, especially in this country. But this is just how slow policing is undone, unfortunately, or especially punitive policing, violent policing is undone.
And I want to come back to this idea about I guess the abuse of the police, the misuse of violence by police, the need for that to be visible as a precursor to change, because I think this comes up in the two cases in the book where we don't see, positive reform of the police, which is in Tajikistan and Kazakhstan. And I gathered the sense that this had, maybe especially in the case of Tajikistan, that this had something to do with urban versus rural police violence, which is, I think, a concept a bit foreign to, at least it seems to me, a bit foreign to the United States, but seems to have more applicability in Central Asia. So I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is applicable in former Soviet space, but it's also applicable in many other parts of the world. It's just, and if something happens in urban areas, first of all, it's more likely that we will have both the imagery, the vivid images, but also coverage of the story. And also we will have urban, mostly middle class activists and the public who will be mobilizing against the government, against the police. It's just that in urban areas in former Soviet space, but maybe also across many other countries, in urban areas, there is a higher density of political life, of discourse, activism, the networks are denser, political participation is more prominent, so that those pre-existing networks, they can really mobilize quickly when there is an event that, you know, usually so gruesome that people can't really, you know, they can't, they really can't tolerate it. And we all know that violence happens all the time in police detention, on the streets, in dark corners, you know, outside of the gaze of cameras, smartphones, but there has to be some kind of compelling visual communication. And there's, you know, in Georgia, for instance, in 2012, it was a prison, it was juveniles where teenagers were sodomized, and there was video footage of that, and that was just for residents of Tbilisi, the capital city, that was just beyond what they can tolerate, and that's how they, mostly young people, also convened in protests. Same was Ukraine. When people saw violence against the first protesters, you know, of student protesters or young, mostly young people who wanted to oppose, who opposed Yanukovych's decline of closer relations with the European Union, when the public saw how the police were brutal with them as the first protesters, they couldn't tolerate it and they came out in their support. And I think, you know, for every country, there is a different threshold of what constitutes violence. But it typically, you know, it's typically in former Soviet space, it's typically some kind of urban outbreak of police violence and clear communication and compelling images that really, you know, sends lightning rods across urban public and compels people to voice their concerns or outrage.
And I'm hoping now that, thank you for your answer. And I'm thinking specifically about kind of the visibility of kind of police reaction to protesters, especially as we see that the last few weeks and even the last few months have been pretty dynamic in terms of popular protests in post-Soviet spaces. So we have the events that were happening in Belarus, and then... you know, it's October 22nd, so we can talk about the very recent events happening in Kyrgyzstan with Sooronbay Jeenbekov's resigning from the government, and then Japarov is now acting president. And even if we look back a little bit further, like we saw when they changed... when they changed the name of the capital in Kazakhstan to Nazarbayev, there were mass protests and those were met with mass arrests. So I'm curious if you, I'm sure you follow some of these events, but I'm curious if you've been kind of watching how the police respond to these protests and whether or not we can see any building movement in any of these places to kind of put a check on police. The police's use of violence and whether or not there have been calls again for reform, or if these are kind of actions that are more focused on concrete political goals at the national level.
Yeah, so you're right that every time we see a protest in former Soviet space, we see the state react. States react with police brutality. And by the way, tactics of police brutality vary. like from instance, for instance, from targeted arrests of people like on the streets of Nur-Sultan, you know, the just as you mentioned, the capital of Kazakhstan, or in Russian cities. And then there was a different tactic used by Lukashenko, who just deploys militarized police units or special units to just round up people, hit them with batons and all that. And I'm always puzzled with autocrats, especially, why do they deploy the police? Because every time they use violence against peaceful protesters, they are just expanding the number of people in the public who support those peaceful protests. And this happens again and again. And I think they think the autocrats think that they will just be able to scare the public and continue as usual. But we see in Belarus now for third month, I think entering fourth month soon, how it doesn't work and the protests persist. And I know that once Lukashenko's regime falls, and it will at some point, sooner or later it will, one of the first calls for reform would be the reform of the police, so that next time there is a public protest like this, that the police are not as brutal and not as politicized. In Kyrgyzstan, the whole turmoil was, was the political factions fighting, and then finally President Jeenbekov resigning. It also was sparked by Jeenbekov deploying police force with tear gas and rubber bullets against peaceful protesters the day after controversial elections. And it didn't scare people off. It just outraged everyone in Bishkek and beyond. And it also created this climate of lawlessness where various political factions used the moment and freed their members from prison, including the current acting president, Japarov, who is a convicted kidnapper, who was freed from prison and just used Supreme Court to rubber stamp his release, the legality of his release from prison, and now he is the acting president. So yeah, this seems to be police brutality, seems to be the first method that any former Soviet autocrat has in mind when seeing crowds convening in capital city usually, but rarely does that really achieve the goals they want to achieve.
And actually it seems to continue the protests or kind of delegitimize the sitting president or the sitting whoever that politician is at the time, making these decisions kind of in the eyes of protesters, but also kind of turn people who might not have been previously opposed to the state. Is that right?
Yep, absolutely. That's absolutely right.
Well, Erica, so thank you for a very enlightening conversation. I think what's really interesting about your work, if I can just say so, is that it seems to be increasingly applicable. I mean, you've written this book 2 years ago, but it's telling us a lot about what's happening in this current moment, whether we look in the United States or, as you say, in Nigeria, but especially in post-Soviet countries. I'm just curious, are there any kind of concluding thoughts you'd like to leave us with, any bits of wisdom about the future of politics in Kyrgyzstan or in Central Asian spaces or in the United States, if you care, before we end our interview?
Mm-hmm. Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for producing this series of podcasts. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and you really ask interesting questions. I just want to remind everyone in the scholarly community, but also just anyone who listens, that police are really what we as society make out of it. And they really reflect how active we are against state repressive instruments, or how passive we are. Are we able to accept it, or are we going to push back by organizing, by demanding that everyone in the society is treated equally and the police are checked by the society. Police are policed by the society. So the more passive we are, the more there will be violence and aggression, because it's the easiest way for any state to operate. But the more active we are, the more there will be hopefully a dialogue and reflection of what we really, as a public, see the most appropriate way for the police to play a role in our everyday lives.
And I think that's a perfect place to end our interview. So I want to thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you.